Hi, welcome to another episode of the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingy, and it's good to have you here with us. Get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. Get a hold of Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at Golf News Net. Download our apps for Roku and Amazon Fire TV. And we have a great show for you this week because we've got a lot to talk about more than anything else. We've got the Ryder Cup to talk about. We've got the actual golf portion of the Ryder Cup to talk about. And we've got the stuff that happened before, during, and after that wasn't golf-related that is seemingly keeping the Ryder Cup in the news well after the fact. The Americans lost 17.5, 10.5 to a European side that was united, played great golf, and never, other than the first session on Friday, appeared even close to losing. And I want to start with the golf portion of it because the golf was what was played, and then get to the maybe ins and outs of why all this stuff kind of unfolded as it did. But the Americans came out with what appeared initially to be a solid game plan. They sent out their best groups. Jim Furyk sent out 8 guys he felt really confident in 4-ball, which is the best ball format, and just let them rip. And it looked like they were going to have 4 points on the board. It looked like they were going to sweep the session and that they were going to put the Europeans on their heels before they got to the afternoon. And then Tommy Fleetwood and Francesco Molinari, who become the best single Ryder Cup duo in the history of the Ryder Cup, at least for Europe, if not ever, they managed to get a point off of Tiger Woods and Patrick Reed. And going from 4-love to 3-1 kind of seemed like a big deal. Instead of losing 3 points, you lost, or 4 points, you lost 2 for the session. So instead of losing by 4, you lost by 2. You basically halved the deficit you faced because of that one match, because the reality is every point you earn is a point the other side doesn't. So it's a 2-point swing in every case. And then you got into the afternoon, and Thomas Bjorn, the captain for the European side, he had a plan. He stuck to the plan. He broke up some of the players that were in groups in the morning. He brought back Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson together as a foursomes team, which is practically unbeatable. He decided to pivot. He brought Molinari and Fleetwood back together for another go at it. He put Rory McIlroy back out there, even though he did not play well whatsoever in the morning session. He brought in Ian Poulter, got to be a spark plug. And he just kind of let those guys go, along with Sergio Garcia and Alex Noren, who needed a rep to get in there and get going. And they swept the session. And that was pretty much it. That was the Ryder Cup right there. It went from looking like a potential 4-0 lead after 4 matches to 3-1 to 7-3. Or excuse me, to 5-3. And that was pretty much all she wrote. Because from there, the Europeans then went to win 3 of 4 matches in the Saturday morning 4-ball session, which included, again, annihilating Tiger Woods and Patrick Reed, because Patrick Reed shot about 83 on his own ball, and Tiger didn't do all that much better in terms of birdie making, and those guys were drubbed. You had Dustin Johnson not really doing much of anything with Ricky Fowler after their initial match. You had really not much of anything working for the Americans in the 16 team matches that make up more than half of the points in the Ryder Cup. There are 28, 16 of them are team matches. The Americans walked into Sunday down 10-6, needing an absolute miracle, which, I mean, we've seen more of those in recent memory, obviously, 1999, 2012. There'd never been a comeback from 4 or more down on foreign soil. And it looked like the way the 12 matches kind of lined up on Sunday, it was a remote possibility. And I threw out on Twitter, hey, here's the path to 8 points to retain the Ryder Cup, to get a 14-14 tie. And a lot of folks on the other side of the pond kind of laughed at me. And not a lot, I mean, like 5 people responded from the other side of the pond. I don't want to blow that out of proportion. And well, it gave me the crying emoji, which I think is like the national emoji for the United Kingdom. Jesus, so many responses with that emoji, or the see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, monkeys, one or the other. And shout out to Mark Crossfield. And it just seemed like there was a chance that if the Americans got off to a really hot start and they maybe pulled off an upset here or there, maybe Webb Simpson somehow beat Justin Rose, and then you kind of got points from basically the first six matches, that on the back end, maybe you would get something. If you could have Bryson maybe get a point from Alex Noren somehow, maybe Reed realized he was Patrick Reed again and beat Tyrrell Hatton, who was a pretty easy match for him. It could happen. It was possible. Not likely, but remotely possible. And for about 30 minutes in there on Sunday, it seemed like it was happening. Like, it was really going to happen. I mean, you had JT beating Rory McIlroy in an unfortunate circumstance on 18 when Rory's drive plugged into a fairway bunker and he had no chance from there, couldn't get it out. Then when he got it out, it dribbled into the water. And then when he hit from the water for five, he basically had to hole it to put pressure on JT. Did not do that. Conceded the match from the fairway. An unfortunate end to a really good match. Then you had Brooks Koepka in match two against Paul Casey, getting to 18. It seemed like Koepka probably had it in hand, and then it just kind of slipped through it. But to get to 18, to hit a perfect drive, to leave himself about 150 yards to a hole playing into the wind, really tough driving hole, really just a difficult finisher. And Casey finds the green going first, and you think, okay, well, Brooks has got wedge in hand, it's to a back pin, he can put air under the ball, and he can just drop it right in there and win this match. And instead, he tugs it into the bunker on the left. For a guy that won two majors this year and looked cold-blooded in doing it, that moment seemed to indicate that maybe Brooks was a little bit more nervous than he lets on. And he kind of got on himself a little bit, but he got up and down and saved a half point, which is not bad, although it probably needed to be a full point to kind of keep things going. Justin Rose somehow loses to Webb Simpson, who was the MVP other than Justin Thomas. Tony Finau just decimated Tommy Fleetwood, which wasn't expected. I mean, I kind of looked at the path of how to get to eight. I figured, well, Fleetwood was probably going to win, and Molinari would win because they played perfect golf. There's no reason for them not to continue other than that they were tired. And Fleetwood didn't play bad golf. He just didn't putt as well as he normally does. And Finau putted way better than he normally does and played 600 golf through 14 holes on his own ball and won the match. And you're starting to think, okay, well, if Tiger can get John Rahm, and then you start going down the line, and Tiger makes the eagle on 9 to get to one down to Rahm, you're like, all right, it's happening. It's all happening. It's all for real. All you just need is the guys that are getting drubbed behind you to do something. You need Bubba to do something. You need Ricky to do something. You need Phil to do something. One of those three people has to do something. They have to flip what's going to need to be flipped. And then you need Tiger to finish off his. And then you're like, all right, well, Reed's going to win because Hatton's down. Bryson gets out of the gate well. That's it. We've got it. Here's 8. And then literally everything fell apart. Everything fell apart. I mean, it was just Dustin Johnson gave up what appeared to be a sure point from Ian Poulter and practically handed it to him in a box and said, here's your Ryder Cup. Handed him that point. Took what was a win, turned into a loss. That was problem one. Problem two, Tiger Woods didn't do anything after that 9th hole. Hardly anything. And he booted a putt on 14 to effectively give up the match to John Rahm. So that happened. Phil, for as horrible as he played in the opening holes and in the one match he played on the opening day, he had a little bit of pride, showed a little bit of rally, and got it reasonably close against Molinari. I think it was close as was one down. And then proceeded to absolute crap the bed the rest of the way. And Bubba Watson got waxed. He was never in it against Henrik Stenson. Ricky Fowler really never made that good of a go of it against Sergio Garcia, who wrapped up his singles point to become the leading point earner all time in the Ryder Cup, passing Nick Faldo both sides. Most points ever, 25 and a half, which is great for Sergio, good for him. And then you get to the point where all the matches that are still out there that could have meant something are now dormy. So Europe has clinched the Ryder Cup. It's just a matter of which American will fail first and give the Ryder Cup officially to Europe. And as it turns out, fittingly, it was Phil Mickelson, who absolutely laser-hooked his tee shot on the par 3 16th, 15, 20 feet into the guarding water hazard. Hats off and handshakes. Ryder Cup goes to Europe at the hands of Phil Mickelson, practically donating the point to Francesco Molinari, who became the first European golfer in the history of this competition, dating back to 1927, of becoming the first guy from that the other side, the non-American side, whether that's Great Britain and Ireland, or continental Europe, to earn 5 points against no losses and no ties in a single Ryder Cup. And I say that caveat because there used to be 32 matches in the Ryder Cup for about 12 years in there. I believe it was from 1961 or 63 to 73 or to 75. And then they changed it to the current format, which is 28 points. And so you had opportunities for players to go technically 6-0 in the Ryder Cup because there were six sessions. There were two each day for 3 days. So you had morning foursomes and foursomes and four balls, and then singles on Sunday. It wasn't just 12. It was eight of 12 or 8 of 10 went out in the morning for singles, and then they had another singles round the afternoon. But nonetheless, there had been three Americans who had gone 5-0-0 in a Ryder Cup. Two of them were in the same Ryder Cup in 1967. Arnold Palmer was among them. And then you had Larry Nelson go 5-0-0 in 1979, the first year Continental Europe was involved. But you didn't have a European do it. And Francesco Molinari, who's completing the best year of his life as a professional golfer, did it. He won the Open Championship this year. He became the first to go 5-0-0. And if you want to kind of create a really weird club of people who have very specific accomplishments in golf history, there are two people who have won the Masters and gone with a perfect record of 5-0-0 or better in the Ryder Cup. Francesco Molinari and Arnold Palmer. And if you want to create the club of guys who have won the Open, gone 5-0-0, and caddied at the Masters, well, there's your only man. That's Francesco Molinari, who caddied for Eduardo Molinari, what was that, 12 years ago in the Ryder Cup, or in the Masters? So he enters some incredible company with what he accomplished this week. And it's a testament to what he's done to make him a better overall golfer. He's worked with Dennis Pugh for years, who does some Sky Sports analysis, but does a lot of teaching, and he's stuck with him over the years, and he's worked hard to become a better putter, to match the ball striking that's always really been there, but it's been finicky putting. And for whatever reason, what has worked for him on the greens is finding a rhythm that feels more like his pre-shot routine for full shots, for regular shots. Get up there, get ready, take your practice cuts, get ready, and go. And that's meant the world to him. And he made a lot of clutch putts. It wasn't just Tommy Fleetwood, who felt like his legs were as wide as 3-meter sticks at times throughout the week because he was just dropping so low in celebration. Those guys contributed fairly equally to what the end result was, which was them going 4-0-0 together and combined going 9-1 in this Ryder Cup. And that's really the difference, because if you take their three victories over Tiger Woods plus someone else, whether that's two over Patrick Reed or one with Bryson DeChambeau in foursomes, whatever route you want to take, they beat Tiger in all three of his team matches. That's a difference of 6 points. Well, the Europeans won by 7, so if Tiger, I'm not saying if Tiger should have won all three of those matches, I'm not saying that at all, but that singularity alone of Tiger and partner losing to Molinari and Fleetwood, that's the difference in the Ryder Cup, pretty much. I mean, you need one other point there somewhere. I'm sure there's one out there we could find, Dustin Johnson against Ian Poulter, that could have gone the other way and would have meant the difference between the Americans winning or losing. And so you have a variety of different American players and American strategies that you can point to as to why the Americans lost. And the Americans are typically very good at coming up with excuses for why they failed. And it's usually very dour when they lose. Oh, so sad, so emotional, we tried so hard. It's not good. It's not a good press conference. The European losing press conferences are as good as their winning press conferences. They're a great jovial bunch. They had a great time, regardless of how it turned out, and they kind of keep a light air about the whole thing, which is probably why they win all the time. As Shane Ryan kind of said on his article for Golf World, it is partially a cultural thing. It is partially an understanding of how to deal with loss, how to deal with entitlement and not winning and working as a group. And there are a lot of dynamics there. The Europeans seem to understand better than the Americans, at least for that 1 week every 2 years. I'm not saying that no European player is selfish or doesn't have an ego or doesn't want the things that they want or expects to be pampered or gets a little butthurt from time to time. I'm not saying any of that at all. But they are able to put all that squashed stuff in the corner for a few days of the Ryder Cup and just agree to be together as a team and see where that leads them. And it, in 9 of the last 12 times they played this thing, has led them to victory. The American team couldn't do that. And this kind of leads into the second half of the show, which is all of the stuff that we didn't really know about, maybe had an inkling about, maybe didn't, but the stuff that was going on in the American team room, even before they got to Paris, frankly, that led to their likely demise. And I kind of said this a couple of different times on Twitter over the course of the week, but I said, I think on Tuesday or Wednesday, I thought the Americans were in trouble. And a bunch of Americans, again, kind of like the Europeans did when I said there was a path to eight, there was a path to eight, just didn't do it, why I thought the Americans were in trouble. And I had a number of people say to me, you're crazy. The Americans are going to win. They've got this. They're the best they've ever been. Their average ranking's like 10. How can you not like that? How can you not expect them to win? And my rationale was simple. Even though I didn't try to dig into it too much with each individual tweeter, my thought was, Jim Furyk didn't have 8 guys he could rely on. At a minimum, to win a Ryder Cup, you need 8 guys that can play. Why? Because you need 4 twosomes that can be competitive, that can at least get you 50-50, and then get to the singles, which typically is an American thing. It's their specialty. I know that the singles matches are effectively separated by a point over like the last 30 years, but the reason that is because so many single Sundays have turned into a coronation, or depending on who's doing it, a death march for the Americans, because they were never in it. It was like they, this past Sunday, when they were 4 down and needed everything to go right to have a chance, and when it didn't, everything failed. And they lost the session 7.5 to 4.5. And so you kind of have to create 4, 5, 6, whatever, numbers of twosomes that can get points, and at least to parity, at least 8 before you get to Sunday. And Jim Furyk didn't have that. He had one that he believed in, which was Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, and that proved right. They went 3-1 together. Went great. Everything else was a failure. Dustin Johnson and Ricky Fowler. Ricky Fowler is basically the human coin flip in the Ryder Cup. I mean, he is basically a 50-50 proposition to earn you a point, which means he's worth a half point every time he goes out and plays. Dustin Johnson did not perform well, and Brooks Koepka, for his part, didn't perform that great either. And it never looked like he was really particularly comfortable playing. And then Reed, as we mentioned, basically was a 15 handicap on Saturday morning. He was lining up way to the right to hit these absurd hooks all throughout the week. He can't handle the wind well, so when the wind blew up, and no one really talked about this as much, but the wind kicked up a lot more than I think people would have anticipated from the American side thinking about France, but if you've ever watched the French Open, it is a pretty windy affair. And so Thomas Bjorn knew that and decided quickly when the wind manifested itself, and then he had a lethal pairing in Fleetwood and Molinari, I'm going to send out the flushers. I'm going to send out the guys who hit the ball hard and hit it the right trajectory for this wind and who have an understanding of this golf course, and I'm going to let them go play golf because they're going to stick it close and they're going to put pressure on the Americans because they're going to go first more often than not from the fairway, and when they hit it in, the Americans are going to have 1 or 2 or 3 less clubs, but they're going to have 4 or 5 or 6 times more pressure because the ball will be close. They have to replicate that, knowing that their opponent hit it from way behind them, and they've got a lesser club, and that they're the Americans, damn it. They're better, they're longer, they're straighter, they're whatever they think they are. I should be able to stick this closer. And the pressure catches up to them eventually. And that's what happened in a lot of matches. I mean, that's the Brooks Koepka wedge into 18 in a nutshell. That's how match play works. You don't have to be the longest hitter to win a match play. It has nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with winning on the PGA Tour a lot of weeks. But it's second shot golf that wins you match play. Driver sets up wedge, driver sets up short iron in a lot of PGA Tour events, and both of those shots matter. Maybe not equally, but they matter, you know, 1.5 to 1 on each other. Frankly, being in a position to just be in the fairway, to have a clear second shot to apply pressure, it doesn't matter how long you are. It generally matters how straight you are, and it matters how you feel going first. And going first again and again and again and again and again. In match play, that's usually a good thing. In stroke play, that can often be a bad thing. You assume that you're, the table's turned. You assume the opponent in front of you is going to stick it close. And in match play, you get the opportunity to stick it close first. And for whatever reason, that dynamic turns on its head between match play and stroke play. And that's why Bjorn sent out the guys that he did. That's why he picked who he did. He picked Henrik Stenson not because he's 42 and ailing, but because he leads the PGA Tour in fairways hit. He picked Sergio Garcia not because he missed the cut in all four majors this year, but because he loves the Ryder Cup and is a generational ball striker, maybe one of the greatest ball strikers to ever live in golf. He picked Paul Casey not because he's particularly great as a putter or even as a driver, but he flushes the ball a lot, and it makes it a whole lot easier when you've got a guy like that hitting second shots in for your team. And he just kind of managed to hit on all of his captain's picks. He found the guys that needed to round out his team, that needed to fit the golf course, and also, in these cases, had experience that worked in that team's favor. And he stepped away from guys like Rafa Cabrera-Bello and Eddie Pepperell and Matt Wallace, all guys who would have been fine. I'm sure they would have been fine. They're world-class golfers. But in front of Bjorn were guys that had done it before and knew how to do it on this golf course and were the perfect fit. And so he picked them, and they were great. They earned 9.5 points. The American captain's picks earned 2. They went 2-10. That's bad. That's really, really, really bad. The only one of those captain's picks that did anything, I mean literally anything, earned points, was Tony Finau, who should have played more. Tony Finau was great. He played confidently. He played competently. He is not the straightest driver by any stretch of the imagination, but he was effective because he knew how to play. He knew how to make it work, his game work, for the golf course and the conditions that week. That's why he was effective. Webb Simpson played great this week. And he played great because he knows how to play this kind of golf course. And there were a lot of inferences and comparisons made between Le Golf National and TPC Sawgrass. And many of them are fairly accurate. Not exactly the same. Rough was deeper. Fairway was a little bit narrower. But generally speaking, pretty accurate. You had to play target golf. It didn't matter how long you were. And if you could just find a way to get on putting surfaces that were pretty big, if you just got a little bit closer than your opponent, you had a really good opportunity to win holes because your opponent was more often than not, if not hitting it close, facing a 30, 40, or 50 footer, which made it difficult to two putt. You're playing from a defensive position. Webb Simpson did a great job playing match play golf, and he took out Justin Rose. He took out a guy who was number one a couple of weeks ago. That is remarkable. He was the guy who carried Bubba Watson to a point in foursomes when Bubba Watson had no business playing at all. I mean, it was horrific golf, and he managed to get a point out of two matches with him. That's remarkable. Way to go, Webb Simpson. For all the people that have derided him over the years as being bland, boring, not exciting, whatever, he did a great service this week for the American team. In a losing effort, but did great. And Justin Thomas, he is the leader. He is the guy that's going to carry the Americans for 20 years. It's not Jordan Spieth. I firmly believe that. It's not Dustin Johnson, who's about the same age as me. He's darn near 36. So that's not it. It could be Brooks Koepka, who's young. Tony Finau's kind of in between. Bryson DeChambeau is going to be back. But he got a bad deal. he got on this team on the back of finishing, what, ninth in points. He had three wins this season by the time the picks were made. And what does Jim Furyk do but make the baffling decision to send him out in his first match against Phil Mickelson, who everyone knew, literally everybody knew, was going to fail. Because he, first, stinks at the Ryder Cup. Second, especially stinks in foursomes. And third, was on the range the entire week just trying to figure something out. So everyone on the grounds knew Phil was in trouble. He didn't feel good about his game. And what do? You send out Mickelson in a format where he has to contribute on every hole. It's not like four ball where Mickelson is just kind of a tag along, and if he contributes a birdie here and there, great. He matters. He tees off on holes. He putts. It matters. And you sent DeChambeau, a guy who is a little temperamental to begin with, gets easily frustrated, and you sent him out there with a guy who couldn't hit French territory from the Eiffel Tower. That is a horrible mistake. And at that point, when that pairing went out, you figured, all right, well, maybe Furyk's an idiot, but he's not an idiot. And so you knew that in the back of your head. I mean, Jim Furyk's not dumb. If you've heard him talk, you know he's not an idiot. And so he couldn't have been dumb, so why did he make that horrible mistake of a pairing? Why did he do that? Why did he insist on sending Tiger out with Patrick Reed when it was clear from the first match that Reed was intimidated and did not feel comfortable playing with Woods? Why did those things happen? And then you start to think about all of the interpersonal stuff that has come out in the days since. And it starts, of course, with Reed. And that's only because of the timeline of things. Because in the news conference, the American team news conference, there's a question asked of both Spieth and Reed about their breakup and how it went. And Spieth and Reed look each other after the question. And Spieth decides he's going to answer, because I think Reed probably knew he was going to go scorched earth if he did answer. So he gives it to Spieth, who basically says, well, Jim kind of let the players make the decisions, and he was very player-friendly, and that was kind of the end of it. And that was not what Patrick Reed believed happened. So Patrick Reed then speaks with Karen Krause from the New York Times, who does a great job with her piece, and Patrick Reed basically says, I wanted to play with Spieth. I was told I'm not playing with Spieth. I got pissed off. And then I didn't get anything from Tiger, who I guess was my second pick. And Tiger apologized to me for losing that Friday four-ball match. Never mentioning in his quotes that he shot 902 in the Saturday morning four-ball and that he should have groveled to Tiger for the privilege of playing with him, given that he was basically a bystander for 3.5 hours in that match. And then he has the gall to say that he shouldn't have been sat out twice for a guy with his Ryder Cup record. The ego to say that is remarkable. And I realize, and a lot of the feedback from some folks who kind of want to defend Reed to some extent is, well, you didn't say this about Phil in 2014. Phil was also inappropriate in the moment that he came out and just threw Tom Watson under the bus for a variety of reasons. But at least from his perspective, from the player perspective, he felt he had the sanctioning, the blessing of the other 11 people on the team. It didn't feel that way about Patrick Reed in the way that he spoke. And ultimately, it came across as a guy who was speaking ironically, and he wasn't, because he goes on to say, well, there was a poster in the team room that check your ego or leave your ego at the door or whatever. Well, Reed didn't do that. He let his ego control him. He got to a situation where he felt upset, betrayed, whatever, by either Spieth or Furyk or both, because Furyk allowed Spieth to play with Thomas, which again was a successful duo, so that was fine. And Furyk had a good idea in his head, at least in concept, that why would you take a successful duo, split them up, and try to make two good duos? Then you were that closer to having four pairings that could, in concept, single-handedly get you in position to win the Ryder Cup. So he chose to do that. And Reed had played like junk since the U.S. Open. He wasn't in form. Frankly, neither was Jordan Spieth. But he figured, okay, Spieth can play with his buddy, Justin Thomas, who's been in great form all year, who is a number one caliber player in the world, who is in position to potentially win the FedEx Cup. Maybe they'll inspire each other, just being friendly and a little rub off there. That worked. Well, you got to find someone for Reed. Someone's got to inspire Reed to play good golf and get him to remember the badass that he's been since 2014 in these team matches. And apparently that guy was supposed to be Tiger Woods, but Tiger Woods just doesn't work in the Ryder Cup. He doesn't work in the Ryder Cup for a variety of reasons. One, he doesn't care. Not that I shouldn't say he doesn't care. He cares, but not in the same way he cares about his individual records or in the majors or the PGA Tour. Ultimately, a team setting has no bearing on how we think of Tiger Woods as the first or second best golfer of all time. And so you can kind of step away from it and go, it doesn't really matter that much. He looked checked out on Sunday. He looked apathetic to the whole thing. One, he was probably gassed from playing so much golf just to get through to this point, to get to that 80th PGA Tour victory, the Tour Championship, then to make this. And he probably was a whole lot happier the last couple of team matches being the chess master and sending out the puppets to dance. And then when they succeeded, he looked like a genius. And he didn't have to do any of the work. And he didn't have to be invested. He didn't have to tire himself out. That's what he wanted to do. But he made the team, and you weren't going to leave him off of it, because how could you after what he'd done in the summertime? He had to play. He had to be a part of it. But he also had to play in the playoffs. He felt like he was chasing that 80th win. He was close. He was going to get it, and the playoffs were his chance to do it. So he was going to compete in each of the playoff events to do it. He was conflicted. But either way, in all of his Ryder Cup history, Tiger Woods has the second most losses, combined losses. Phil Mickelson has the most thanks to his meltdown against Molinari. And Tiger just cannot play in foursomes. And singles, he's okay. He's generally pretty solid. And if you get him in four balls, honestly, not that great either. Doesn't like relying on other people. And Patrick Reed was literally relying on Tiger Woods for these couple of days to restore his good name. And when that wasn't happening, Reed probably was frustrated. He was probably frustrated he played like crap. And he was looking for someone or something to blame to help himself. To help himself get over it. To get over it this year, to get to next year. To get to the President's Cup where Tiger's the captain. I guess he could be the playing captain. But I assume he's not going to play. And then, what do you do? What do you do if you're Furyk? Now you've got Reed all upset. You've got him searching for a partner. It should have been Tiger and Bryson, probably. That would have made more sense. You send them out in four balls, let them try and figure it out. If it's great, you send them out in foursomes. Instead, that didn't work because Reed insisted, begged, according to an anonymous source, which I think is kind of cowardly, to the New York Post. He begged to play with Tiger, had to play with Tiger. Well, didn't work. So now if you're Furyk, you're like, well, I'm not going to send Tiger out every session. He's too tired. I can't do that. I need to put Bryson with somebody. I didn't send him out right away. Phil, you're available. Get on out there in a format we know you're going to lose. That was a no-win situation. You tethered Webb Simpson and Bubba Watson. Bubba was apparently completely disengaged from the start. He was motivated 2 years ago because he didn't make the team as the world number seven. And he wanted to prove that he could get back to it. And he won three times on the PGA Tour this year. He earned his place on the team on points. But he was garbage after June. Just like Reed. One more week. Travelers. Garbage after that. Stunk, stunk, stunk. And the only person that I guess they think can supposedly babysit Bubba Watson out there was Webb Simpson. Then you go, okay, well, Webb, we don't really like you in the four ball. But we're going to send you out there with Webb and Bubba in the foursomes. Good luck. Meanwhile, Watson is under the weather. He's not interested. He's apathetic. And he stinks on foreign soil. He never wins on foreign soil. That was a disaster from the start. You should have benched Watson and Mickelson from the beginning and just hoped with the other 10 that you had to make something of nothing. And instead you had DJ who couldn't putt, searching for a putter, for a grip, for both. At multiple times throughout the week. You had Brooks, who was apparently frustrated with Dustin Johnson for some reason, because they got into some kind of altercation on the flight from Atlanta to Paris. And Jim Furyk got in front of them, basically said, shut the hell up, put this stuff aside for a few days, and we can come back to it when it's done. I need you both. So obviously they couldn't have been a very effective duo. They played once and stunk it up. Then you had it just goes on like this. And you had Ricky Fowler. Who is Ricky Fowler? He is who he is. He's good enough to make these teams because he's a world-class player. But he has never found the clutch gene. It's why he's going to struggle to win a major championship unless he kind of backs into one and then realizes, hey, I can do it, kind of like Phil did. And he's always going to be mediocre in the Ryder Cup because for whatever reason, he just doesn't have that killer instinct to crush when the time comes. You got Tony Finau, who was apparently treated with kid gloves. He should have played more often. It just was a kind of calamity of issues leading up to it that put Jim Furyk in a position where he had basically one path to win, and it was a long shot. And that was send out your best duos in four ball. Hope you win 7 or 8 points. 6, 7, or 8 points. And then hope that you just don't get crushed in the 8 foursomes matches. And instead, they got crushed in all the matches. If the Americans had found a way to go 3-1 in both of those sessions, both the four-ball sessions, instead of the way that it went, where the Europeans wound up winning 8 consecutive matches between the 1 ending Friday morning, the 4 in Friday afternoon, and 3 of the 4 on Saturday morning, then you had a tie ball game, because that's 2 more points for the Americans. That's a 4-point swing. That's a tie. Now, all of a sudden, you have a team that is capable of potentially letting their individual talent work ahead of them and win the Ryder Cup, or at least tie. I understand where Jim Furyk was coming from. I get the path. I get why he thought that way, because he realized probably on Wednesday morning he was screwed. He had no chance. Kind of like Darren Clark didn't really have a chance in 2016. He had a half of a team of rookies. None of them were really informed by the time they got there except Thomas Peters. You had Danny Willett's brother running his mouth like an asshole. You had Chris Wood, who wasn't ready to play. Matt Fitzpatrick was overwhelmed at the length of the golf course. Andy Sullivan's too temperamental. Go down the line. Just go down the line of guys that were not going to be effective. And so Darren Clark never had a chance. He had to find the one and one path only to winning the Ryder Cup, and he didn't hit it. And so now you've got a team that's in turmoil. I don't know where Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka are personally. We're not going to find that out probably for a little while. I know Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed are never going to team together again. I know Phil Mickelson is never going to play another road game in the Ryder Cup unless he has Ray Foyd's blood infused into him before 2021. He may make the 2020 Ryder Cup. Maybe it's an outside chance. Tiger probably will if his health holds up and he continues to be this kind of guy. He could play again. Dustin Johnson's not a guarantee. Dustin Johnson is nearly 36. He is at a point in his life where he's at a crossroads. He's got a couple of kids. I don't know what his situation is with Paulina Gretzky, whether it's good or bad. If it goes bad, he's basically going to be a single dad. He will want to be a dad to his kids. That seems pretty apparent from who he is. And he's going to search for answers. And life may get more important than golf. You've got Brooks Koepka, who's going to be a force. You've got Justin Thomas, who's going to be a force. You've got Ricky Fowler, who's going to continue to make these teams, whether you like it or not. Bryson DeChambeau is going to make another one of these teams. Tony Finau seems to be on the trajectory to continue to make a few more of these teams. You got Jordan Spieth, who will certainly be a part of this for probably years to come. I mean, I know he had his worst professional season this year, and I think I've talked about this secret take 2 years ago at the Ryder Cup. I said I thought Jordan Spieth would fall out of the top 50 in the world by the time we got to the next Ryder Cup. I didn't quite get there with it. He didn't wind up being outside the top 50 in the world, but if you look at his year, he was 2 to start the year. He is now 10. He's in position to drop a fair number of points here. He's probably not going to play a whole ton of golf down the stretch. Not to say there's going to be some kind of precipitous fall for him, but the points that he's kind of got from the last couple of years, he's got a bunch falling off in the coming weeks and months. So all of a sudden, he's going to be looking for points from wins. He's got a major championship win, a traveler's win that's coming off. He's got some second place finishes that come off next year. If he doesn't figure it out, if he doesn't figure out what the heck's going on, he could find himself in a position where he's like 35th in the world by the middle of next year. But if he figures it out and he kind of gathers things together, and maybe this week was a good sign for him, even though he was absolutely shellacked by Torbjørn Olesen in the singles, which kind of was surprising but kind of wasn't, then things could be good for him. And I will say, I didn't mention Spieth earlier. I should have, because I wrote about it for Golf News Net. But one really interesting thing to me about Spieth is that he hasn't won a singles match in any of his team competitions as a professional. Never has. I think it's 0-6. And we talked about that, but we talk about that in isolation. Like, oh, he can't win. He doesn't win a singles match. Well, if you look back at the numbers, of the 30 possible matches that Jordan Spieth could have played in 6 appearances for the Americans between the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup, Jordan Spieth has played in 28 of 30 sessions. I don't care if you're young or not. That's a lot of golf. And that means heading into the final day of all of those competitions, all 6 of them, he either played 3 or 4 matches. More often than not, 4 matches. And that means he was gassed. So maybe Spieth needs to sit. Just once. And that goes to what Furyk's original plan was, which was to have no player play in 5 matches. That he wanted everyone to spread the wealth, because he knows and he knew the impact of playing 5 matches. That's why Tommy Fleetwood got whacked on Sunday. Francesco Molinari worked through it, but all the other guys were not in a position to ever have to worry about 5 matches, because that wasn't the point. You don't want guys playing 5 matches unless they went 4-0, and you don't get guys a 4th match unless they go 3-0, and so it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense. You can't have someone like Jordan Spieth, who continually loses singles matches, playing 4 matches going into a 5th. It clearly does not work in his favor. And so moving forward, you need Jordan Spieth to be a 4-match guy. That's a little bit less of a burden. That's good. You got Justin Thomas. You got some other names to work around, as we mentioned. So who leads them? Who leads this process? Well, for one, I think it's important to mention that the Ryder Cup committee, the task force, whatever, the task force did some good things. It moved power away from the PGA of America, and it moved it into the hands of the players. The bad thing that it did was it moved the power from the PGA of America to a very specific set of players. It moved it into the hands of Tiger Woods and David Sloan III and Phil Mickelson and Jim Furyk and Steve Stricker, and to some extent Tom Lehman, but he's not playing. So and neither is David Sloan III, obviously. So you basically handed the power over to a specific set of people and let them run wild with it. And that really wasn't much any better. And they tried to be a little bit more transparent, and they tried to give the players a little bit more say. But ultimately, what happened with Spieth Reed seems to be a pretty clear indication that Spieth was going to get his way because he's Jordan Spieth. And Justin Thomas, I don't know what input he had on that. We haven't really talked about it much. No one in the media is focused upon it. I don't know what his role is in all of this. I'm sure he wasn't an innocent bystander. He's like, I'll play with whoever. Probably didn't work out that way. So, you've got these guys now who are all going to get turns at being captain, right? Davis Love got 2 turns. 2012, should have won. 2016, got his makeup. You had Jim Furyk, who was part of this. He got his captaincy. Unfortunately, he got rolled by bad circumstances. Oh, and bad play. But bad circumstances in a lot of ways. That he could not have helped, given what he had in front of him on Wednesday. So now you've got Phil, you've got Tiger, and you've got Steve Stricker to be captains. You've probably got Steve Stricker in 2020 in Wisconsin. He's from Wisconsin, if you haven't heard. In 2022, you potentially have Tiger as captain in Italy, although that could switch to Adair Manor. We'll see. You probably have him for a road game. And then you've got Phil in 2024 at Bethpage, because the people of Long Island absolutely love Phil Mickelson. So you have these 3 guys who are basically guaranteed to be the brain trust for the next 6 years of this Ryder Cup, if not longer, probably a decade, if it all kind of works out. And if you're a younger player, you kind of have to fit their mold. You have to fit their decision-making. You have to kind of go with them, their leadership style. And if it doesn't work for you, well, you don't have a choice unless something drastic changes. So I feel like the Ryder Cup committee was good in some ways, but now it's kind of gotten to the point where they're part of the problem. They're not part of the solution. They tried their hand at a solution and may have inadvertently created some problems in the process. Meanwhile, the Europeans could probably insert anybody as captain, and because they have a culture and a playbook, yeah, they might lose in 2020, but I doubt they would lose in 2022, wherever it's played in Europe. So you've got Patrick Harrington to come over in 2020 to be the captain. That's what it sounds like it's going to be. That's fine. You've got Harrington against Steve Stricker. 2022, some names can float about for that. We'll get there when we get there. Maybe Graham McDowell by then. Maybe Ian Poulter by then. I don't know. But for the immediate future on the American side, it doesn't look like things are really going to change. I mean, you could interchange guys who come and go, but the bulk of the American team, the guys who are under 35 at this point, are probably still going to be there. Webb will probably be back if he continues this kind of path. Maybe not. Bubba probably will not be. I kind of foresee a situation where he goes through a precipitous decline. Tiger and Phil are going to start to exit. So Kuchar's probably not going to be really a part of this moving forward. So you're going to have an infusion of blood. But that infusion of blood only goes so far as to make sure that it helps the team, and that's only if they're accepted into this culture, and the people who are running that culture are the guys who have been getting their asses kicked by Europe for 25 years. I don't know if that's a good thing. If I were running the Ryder Cup committee, and I'm not, obviously, but I would look at bringing in new blood to lead. I would, if I were Phil and Tiger, if I were Jim and Davis, I would say, we need a leader that's not us. Not Steve Stricker. We need someone who can connect with these players and guide them and lead them, and we can kind of do some of the chess piece work. But it basically has been two consecutive Ryder Cups of Phil and Tiger's shadow captains, and they thought they had been successful because they also won a President's Cup, and they figured it would work in France. And unfortunately, a bunch of things just did not work in their favor. So we'll see where it goes moving forward. I'm sure there's still more to find out in terms of these interpersonal conflicts, the fights that Brooks and DJ had. I'm sure there will be more about it. I'm sure there will be more anonymous sources. We've got a long offseason. Well, actually, the PGA Tour starts this week. Safeway Open in Napa, California. Golf never stops. Don't you ever forget, golf never stops. We've got the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship this week over in the UK. Their version of the Pebble Beach Pro-Am is a great event. It's going to be better than the Safeway. Watch that. The UL International Crown in South Korea, that'll be a prime time in the United States. That's a great competition going in its third go-around. You should watch that as well if you have some time. If you catch Safeway, great. You're not really missing that much, but you can get a good glimpse of the guys who are coming off the Web.com Tour and Web.com Tour Finals. They're going to be hungry and ready to play. Brendan Seale's a two-time defending champion. Be curious to see how it all kind of plays out. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Next time we will come back, talk about some other issues in the game, and we'll get some more news from the Ryder Cup, maybe circle back on that end and try to put some more things together in terms of the ways of guests to getting us through the fall and then into our December break as usual. Thanks as always for listening. If you listen to us through iTunes, give us a 5-star rating on our page. Helps us reach more people. If you want to send me an email, shoot me a good old email message, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or you can follow me on Twitter @RyanBalanchy. Until next time, I'm Ryan Balanchy saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.